cellular needs. So the phosphorylation, the covalent modification deals with system line needs, and allosteric modification or allosteric control deals with the cellular needs. Is a rough rule of thumb that you can use for this. Let's just presume for our moment that we actually have 100 copies of this enzyme in the cell. It's just a round number. I don't know how close to reality it is, but let's just assume 100. What this process is doing is changing the relative proportion of those 100 glycogen phosphorylase molecules into an inactive or active form, depending on the needs of the system and of the cell. So, for the sake of argument, we could presume that there's 25 copies like this, 25 copies like this, 25 copies like this, and 25 copies like that, which means that essentially half are active and half are not active. I mean, this is just a make-believe setup. I'm just trying to get you to realize that these modifications are acting on a pool of these molecules. And there's seldom any molecule or enzyme that's all of one state. It would be extraordinarily unusual if an enzyme was so highly modified that every copy of the enzyme was in a particular state. This is because the body has to have some ability to adapt. And if you lose the adaptability when you convert all of something into something else, there's no adaptability in it. So invariably, even under the most extreme circumstances, there will be a small fraction of these molecules, the glycogen phosphorylase, that's going to be in the inactive form. The particular enzyme may be changing in and out of that form. There's a dynamic that this pool, there's a dynamic to it, but it's going to be unusual. So tell me what happens. What does the phosphorylase kinase do to this enzyme? Phosphorylate it. If it's phosphorylated, the predominant form then becomes what? Active or inactive? Active. Because you can tell, as soon as it gets into that phosphorylated form, it moves to the phosphorylase A. It changes its conformation. What is the role of phosphoprotein phosphatase? What does it do? Removes phosphate and thus creates a situation where the tendency is for a dephosphorylated glycogen phosphorylase to be what? Inactive. Is there an opportunity for the dephosphorylated form to become active? Under what conditions within the cell? High levels of what? AMP. Is that the favored form? No. You can tell by the arrow, the favored form is the inactive. Could you presume that based on this, the fact that these arrows are existing, that there's a continuous equilibrium between these two forms, but that the equilibrium favors the inactive form? Can you say that? Yes. If you were having an extreme situation where you wanted the enzyme to shut down, that if you had high levels of ATP and G6P, that it would even force the equilibrium more toward the inactive form? Can you say that? Yeah. Okay. All right, well, I think then we've pretty thoroughly beaten this particular regulatory horse to death, all right? And the reason why I'm doing that is because it gives an excellent model for the other kind of regulatory forms we're going to see in the future. Because this part of it is now going to be a part of a much larger regulatory pathway that you memorized and that we'll see in a few days. Yes? Red box in the upper right.
Its tendency is to immediately move down to that form?
Correct.
Okay, unlike the red box in the left, its tendency is to remain in that state.
Exactly. Could I force this inactive form, which is wants to be in the active form, can I force it back to the inactive form? With glucose, that's correct. Mm-hmm. That's the allosteric effector. All right. The enzyme may assume the enzymatically inactive T conformation or the catalytically active R conformation. The conformation of phosphorylase B is allosterically controlled by the effectors AMP, ATP, and glucose-6-phosphate, and is mostly in the T state under physiological conditions. In contrast, the phosphorylated form of the enzyme, phosphorylase A, is unresponsive to these effectors and is mostly in the R state unless there is a high level of glucose. Thus, under usual physiological conditions, the enzymatic activity of glycogen phosphorylase is largely determined by its rate of phosphorylation and dephosphorylation. Can phosphorylase kinase and phosphoprotein phosphatase be active at the same time? Yeah, they can, and many times they are. There's a continuous cycling between phosphorylated and dephosphorylated as these enzymes are either turned on or turned off. These enzymes are, in fact, regulated. And you just memorized that when you went through the regulation of the glycogen regulation cascade. You actually did this. I don't know if you noticed it or not. Anyway, so that's that. Very important. Reason why I'm hammering this is because when we see other regulatory pathways, I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to explain it to you. You guys should have some intuition with it. All right. Now then, chapter 13, ladies and gentlemen. Now, so starting here for the next 15 minutes, you can presume that it's going to be on the test. Let's see here. I don't know what that thing is. What is it? Some sort of mouse or something going across there? I don't remember what I did with this. And I think there's one more. Yep, okay, we'll start right there. A bunch of fill-in-the-blanks, ladies and gentlemen. So I'll pause and help you out here. Please write in the following. The first blank is hormone. The next blank is receptor. The next blank is enzyme. The next blank is second. Really? Second? Yeah, second. The next blank is enzyme again. The next blank is cellular. And the next blank on the same line is development. Development. So there were seven so far. There's now another 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 more. After the word hormones, there's a blank called synthesized. Synthesized. Exocrine is the next blank. Paracrine. Autocrine. Autocrine. Homeostasis is the next blank. External. External is the next blank. Metabolism. Initiate cyclic metabolism. Interdependent. Interdependent. The hormones can be made up of polypeptides. Amino acid derivatives is the next blank. Derivatives. Steroids is the last blank. And the last two lines are this: hormones circulating throughout the body bind to specific receptors located on specific cells. Specific cells. All right. So, I'm a guy. At least that's what my chromosomes tell me. Therefore, I should have relatively high circulating levels of what hormone? Testosterone. Do all cells in my body have a testosterone receptor? No, they don't. Some do. Some do. I know my hair follicles have a fairly high, a fairly good receptor for testosterone and its derivatives. That's why I have no hair. Because of the fact that there is testosterone floating in my bloodstream. There's another modification of testosterone that hits a receptor on the hair follicles and shuts them down based on the time, how old you are, the age of the cell. If I was, in fact, sterile, if I was a eunuch, if I'd been castrated as a youth, I would have a full head of hair. A full head of hair. Whenever you see these old movies about the harems, and then you have the eunuchs that are guarding the harems, they all show them, if they're going to be historically accurate, with a full head of flowing hair, sort of like, who's that guy who used to be on covers of romance novels? What was his name? What is it? Fabio, yes, Fabio. How would you like to have Fabio lecturing you in biochemistry? Huh? Would that be a real treat? Yeah. Well, it's too late for me. At any rate, so yes, not every cell has a receptor for every hormone. They don't need to. That's the crucial thing. And there are different receptors on cells for different hormones. You know. For example, the fight or flight. Have you ever heard of people being suddenly so frightened that they lose bladder or bowel control? Yeah, you hear of it. Yeah. Part of it is a hormonal reception. There are hormones that the digestive system is responsible to. Mostly that kind of response is in fact a nerve response, is the loss of control. But for example, yes. Ah. Well, it is because the high levels of testosterone have, in fact, destroyed the cells making the hair. In other words, even if I was castrated today, it wouldn't come back. You might see there is some hair here. I shave it off because it's just funky looking. there is some hair here. If I lost my testosterone, this would come back a little more aggressively. What hair is here? It would never come back like a full head of hair. It's gone. Yes?
What are the various products actually doing that are trying to advertise or storing hair to men
who invest? What happens is they're actually, like Rogaine is a compound that was used for heart medication. And when they were taking Rogaine for this heart medication, they discovered men were growing hair out their ears and their hair was getting a little more fuller. And so they began to see if it would work topically. What it does is it blocks that receptor. It blocks, I don't remember the name of the testosterone derivative, but it blocks that receptor. And when it blocks it, it shuts off inhibition, is what it does. And so it does allow that stuff to start growing a little bit more. Yeah, there are some products that work better. I mean, there are some products that claim you just need to clean your scalp a little bit better and it'll grow. But there are known materials that actually enhance the hair growth out of the follicle cells. And one of them is that Rogaine. I'm not sure about the others. Not to the same extent, no. No, I mean, you'll see when you see these advertisements, it's always the individuals that have thin hair, not no hair. You know, they go from obviously thin to much thicker. And that's relatively easy to do if you catch it in your 30s and early 40s. But I'm beyond hope. Plus, I was never willing to spend the money to put the stuff on my head every day anyway. Too cheap. I'm trying to grow old gracefully. And I'm not sure how well that's happening, but it is what it is. Let's take a look at what's going on here. Signaling pathways begins with a hormone that's circulating past the cell. The cell has a receptor for that hormone. The hormone binds to that receptor. The receptor transmits conformational change through the membrane to an enzyme activity within the cell that typically creates a second messenger or initiates an enzyme cascade that then creates a cellular metabolism change or development change. So that's the written out pathway. And you'll see this listing occur two or three times in this particular chapter. Hormones are synthesized, of course, by endocrine glands that can either act distantly, called exocrine, locally, paracrine, or on themselves, called autocrine. They're typically designed to maintain homeostasis or respond to external events. The old fight or flight syndrome. If you had just had a large breakfast, but you began to realize that you've got to get out of the way because there's a meteor going to crash down on the IHOP that you just ate at, and you're running for your life, the same hormones that allow you, that are stimulating your muscle contractions, energy release, shut down your intestinal tract. So there's the same hormone that high levels stimulate high activity in certain tissues can inhibit reactions in other tissues based on the receptor. So in reality, we never are talking about simply hormones. We must always, in the same breath, talk about receptors. Hormones and hormones receptors are together. Okay, because one hormone may have four or five different receptor types depending on the tissue, some of which turn on a function, some of which turn off a function in the presence of that hormone, as you may have seen in other classes. All right, initiate metabolism, development, all are interrelated and interdependent. I'm going to show you pathways that have been laboriously picked out, laboriously defined, but you will discover to your horror when you get to graduate school or dental school or medical school that they're never as simple as what I'm describing here. I have a little book I should show you. They have pages and pages of these of these regulatory pathways in which there are dozens of interrelated enzymes. All right. Yeah, polypeptides, amino acids, steroids, specific receptors, they're located on specific cells, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Apparently we're going through some sort of lightning process, I guess. I'm not sure. It's been a while since I've ever looked at this. This is entirely too fancy by half. All right. And I'm not sure where it ends. I'm going to stop right there. Okay, again, a bunch of blanks, lots of blanks here. Let's fill this in. The first set of blanks, and you will be responsible for this page, is the first blank on overhead number three is digestive enzymes. Digestive enzymes. The second blank is Langerhans. 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 Islets of Langerhans, or Isles of Langerhans. The next blank is glucagon. The next blank is insulin. And the next blank is somatostatin. Somatostatin. The next blank is muscle. Muscle. The next blank is glucose. Store glucose is glycogen, protein, and fat. Store glucogen. Glucose. Next blank is stimulate. Stimulate. And the next blank in parentheses is called glycogenolysis. 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 Next blank is gluconeogenesis. 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 And release fats from adipose tissue. Lipolysis. LIPOLYSIS. And somatostatin. SOMATOSTATION. Pardon me. Regulates both insulin and glucagon. Next blank is medulla. Medulla. And the next blank is cortex. Cortex. So the adrenal glands produce, the last two blanks are catecholamines. 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 And adrenal cortical, ADRENOCORTICAL, adrenal cortical steroids, cortex. Each bind unique up to receptors, alpha or beta adrenal receptors. So let's quickly run through this. Pancreas, of course, we know produces digestive enzymes. Name a digestive enzyme that it produces. What is it? Oh, you don't know the specific names. Trypsinogen. And let's give a round of applause to trypsinogen. Yay! Why should you give a round of applause to trypsinogen? Does the pancreas produce active and digestive enzymes? No. See, I was hoping someone would say trypsin or chymotrypsin or elastase. But no. You correctly diagnose the issue. It produces the inactive forms of these enzymes, or the activated in situ. All right. Now, it also contains ions of Langerhans, which produce glucagon, insulin, and somatostatin. What does glucagon do? Glucagon stimulates liver to release glucose by breakdown of glycogen, called glycogenolysis, and by synthesis of glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors, gluconeogenesis, and release of fats from adipose tissue called lipolysis. Now, so what happens if you haven't eaten in 18 hours or so? Do you have any glycogen? Say no. No. So how does the liver produce carbohydrate if you don't have any glycogen in it? Gluconeogenesis. Do you remember the four enzymes of gluconeogenesis? Do you remember? And if you remember, gluconeogenesis. Let's start at the bottom. What is it? I'll give you a hint. Pyruvate carboxylase. What's the next one above it? Five letters, all caps. PEPCK, phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. What's the next enzyme? It's way at the top. Fructose-6-phosphatase, as she refers to her notes. Good for her. And the last enzyme at the top is? Glucose-6-phosphatase. Exactly correct. Do your muscles contain glycogen? Say yes. Yes, they do, because we get it from muscle. All right. Do muscles release glucose into the bloodstream? No, because it's missing one of the four enzymes of glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, and that's glucose-6-phosphate. The dirty little secret is it will release glucose equivalents, but it will not release glucose. You can't release glucose out of muscle cells. Okay, you can release them out of liver cells. I'll talk more about that later. Okay, so insulin stimulates muscle, liver, adipose tissue to store glucose as glycogen, protein, and fat. Adipose tissue also stimulates it to absorb fat out of the liver, out of the blood cells, pardon me. So insulin is a signal that says there's too much food equivalents in the blood. It's not just glucose. It can be glucose and fat. It can even be some high levels of protein. It's not just glucose, although glucose is the primary culprit. And glucagon stores goes the opposite way to release it as opposed to store it. The adrenal glands, which are also an important source for hormones, medulla, sympathetic nervous system extension, the cortex, glandular tissue, produces catecholamines, norepinephrine, epinephrine. What's the United States names for norepinephrine and epinephrine? Adrenaline. So it's adrenaline and noradrenaline. And adrenal cortex, steroids, which we will not go too much through in this. But also, like I said, alpha and beta adrenal receptors. So receptors are important as that. Responsible for energy mobilization. That's correct. Especially norepinephrine and epinephrine. That's the fight or flight hormones. The fight or flight hormones. And let's see what's going on here. Doom, doom, doom. I think we are going to stop here. This overhead will not be on the test. So overhead number 3 is where the test stops. And I think we've got a minute. And what we'll do here is we'll fill in the blanks. First blank is glucocorticoids. Next blank is mineral corticoids. Next blank is androgen and estrogen. Gonadal steroidal hormones. Regulation of sexual differentiation. Sexual. Secondary is the next blank. Androgens. Okay. HG is the next blank. And the last blank is excess. Next blank is deficiency. Next blank is, I think I better stop right there. All right, so fill it in as you can. Do we have another blank on this one? Ooh, I've got to put most signals in there. Okay, do we meet tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen? Yes, we do.